as much as from the implacable queen. And she moved forward against them. The dead were holding back the rest of the army, and the baron's men were hacking down the knights all around her, but she didn't stop. There wasn't any white left in her shift. It was bloody, from the ground to the knee. Her mail shirt was dyed red. Her arms and hands were red. Her face was spattered. I looked down the arrow and touched Alyosha's magic. I felt the arrow's eagerness to fly again, to seek warm living flesh. There was a nick in the arrowhead. I smoothed it out with my fingers, pressing the steel flat, the way I'd seen Alyosha work her sword. I pushed a little more magic into it, and felt it grow heavy in my hand, full of death. In the thigh, I told it, quailing at murder. Surely it would be enough just to stop the queen. I pointed it at her, and threw. The arrow dived down, flying straight, whistling joyfully. It struck the queen's leg high up on the thigh and tore through the mail shirt. And then it stuck there, hanging half through the mail. There wasn't any blood. The queen pulled the arrow out, tossed it aside. She looked up towards the window, a brief glance. I stumbled back. She returned to the slaughter. My face ached as if she'd struck me with a sharp, hollow pressure above the bridge of my nose. Familiar. "The wood," I said out loud. "What?" Sarkhan said. "The wood," I said. "The wood is in her." Every spell would cast on the queen, every purging, the holy relics, every trial, none of them mattered. I was suddenly sure. That had been the wood looking back at me. The wood had found a way to hide. I turned to him. "The summoning," I said. "Sarkhan, we have to show them. Marek and Solya, all their men. If they see that she's been taken by the wood." "And you think he'll believe it?" he said. He looked out the window, though, and after a moment said, "All right. We've lost the walls in any case. We'll bring the survivors inside the tower and hope the doors hold long enough for us to cast the spell." Chapter 28. We ran down to the great hall and flung the doors open. The baron's men came pouring in, so horribly few of them left. 100, maybe. They crowded into the hall and down the stairs into the cellars, all of them smudged and exhausted, faces wrung with one horror after another. They were glad to come inside, but they flinched from Sarkhan and from me. Even the baron himself looked at us askance.
"That wasn't them,"
he said, as he came to stand before Sarkhan in the hall, his men eddying to either side of us, leaving a circle around us.
"The dead men."
"No, and if you would have preferred to have lost the rest of the living ones, do tell me, and I'll be sure to keep your tender sensibilities in the mind next time." Sarkhan was drawn tight, and I felt just as spent. I wondered how long it was until morning, and didn't want to ask.
"Let them get what rest they can, and share out all the stores you can find."
Soon Kasha pushed up the stairs, through the crowding soldiers. The baron had sent the wounded and the worst exhausted men downstairs. Only his best remained with him.
"They're breaking into the wine and the beer casks," she said to me in an undertone. "I don't think it's going to be safe for the children. Nyeshka, what's happening?"
Sarkhan had climbed the dais. He was laying out the summoning across the arms of his high seat. He swore under his breath. "That's the last thing we need now. Go down there and turn it all into cider," he told me. I ran down with Kasha. The soldiers were drinking out of cupped hands and helmets, or just jabbing holes in the casks and putting their heads underneath, or tipping back bottles. Some of them were quarreling already. Shouting over wine must have felt safer than shouting over horrors, over dead men and slaughter.
Kasha pushed them out of my way, and they didn't fight her when they saw me there. I got up to the biggest barrel and put my hands on it. Livintalim, I said with a tired shaft of magic, and sagged as it ran away from me and shivered through all the bottles and casks. The soldiers kept on pushing and shoving to get a drink. It would be a while before they realized they weren't getting any drunker. Kasha touched my shoulder carefully, and I turned and hugged her tight for one moment, glad of her strength. I have to go back up, I said. Keep the children safe.
Should I come stand with you?
She said quietly. Keep the children safe, I said.
If you have to.
I caught her arm and took her back to the far wall of the cellar. Stashek and Marisha were sitting up there, awake, and watching the soldiers, wary. Marisha was rubbing her eyes. I put my hands on the wall and found the edge of the passageway. I put Kasha's hand on the crack, showed her where it was, and then I pulled a thin line woven of magic out of it as a handle.
Push the door open and take them inside and close it behind you, I said.
Then I put my hand onto the air and said,
Hato!
Pulling, and drew Alyosha's sword out of the air back to me. I held it out to her.
Keep this, too.
She nodded and slung the sword over her shoulder. I kissed her one last time and ran back upstairs. The Baron's men had all come inside. The walls still did us this much good. Marek's cannon couldn't be turned on the doors. A few of the Baron's men had climbed up to the arrow-slit window seats to either side of them and were shooting down at the soldiers outside. Heavy thumps landed against the door, and once a bright flare of magic, shouts and noise came.
They're laying a fire against the doors!
One of the men called from the window as I came back up into the great hall.
Let them,
Sarkhan said without looking up. I joined him on the dais. He had reshaped the grand throne-like chair into a simple bench of two seats, with a flat desk on the shared arm between them. The heavy volume of the summoning lay upon it, waiting, familiar and still strange. I let myself down slowly into the seat and spread my fingers over the cover, the golden vining letters, the faint hum beneath, like distant honeybees. I was so tired, even my fingers felt dull. We opened the cover and began to read. Sarkhan's voice recited clear and steady, marching on precisely, and slowly the fog over my mind blew away. I hummed and sang and murmured all around him. The soldiers around us grew quiet. They settled down in corners and against the walls, listening the way you would listen in a tavern, to a good singer and a sad song, late at night. Their faces were vaguely puzzled, with trying to follow the story, trying to remember it, even while they were being towed onward by the spell. The spell towed me along with them, and I was glad to lose myself inside it. All the horrors of the day didn't vanish, but the summoning made them only one part of the story, and not the most important part. The power was building, running bright and clean. I felt the spell rising up like a second tower. We'd open the doors when we were ready, and spill the irresistible light into the courtyard before the gates. Outside the windows, the sky was growing lighter. The sun was coming up. The doors creaked. Something was coming in underneath them, over the tops, through the barely there gap between the two doors. The men nearest to them shouted warning. Thin, wriggling shadows were climbing through every tiny crack. Narrow and quick as snakes, the squirming tendrils of vines and roots, crumbling wood and stone as they found ways inside. They spread across the wood like frost, climbing a pane, gripping and grasping, and a familiar, too sweet smell came rolling off them. It was the wood. striking openly now, as if it knew what we were doing, that we were about to expose the deception. The soldiers of the Yellow Marshes were hacking at the tendrils with their swords and knives, afraid. They knew enough of the wood to recognize it, too. But more of the vines kept coming in, through cracks and holes, the first ones opened for them. Outside, Marek's battering ram struck again, and the doors shook from top to bottom. The vines caught at the iron brackets of the hinges and the bar and tore at them. Rust spread in an orange-red pool as quickly as spilling blood, the work of a century in moments. The tendrils pushed inside them, coiled around the bolts, and shook them ferociously back and forth. The brackets rattled noisily. Sarkon and I couldn't stop. We kept reading, tongue stumbling in haste, turning pages as quickly as we could. But the summoning demanded its own pace. The story couldn't be rushed. The edifice of power we'd already built was wavering beneath our speed, like a storyteller about to lose the thread of her own tale. The summoning had us. With a loud splintering crack, a larger corner broke off at the bottom of the right door. More vines came spilling through, thicker ones, uncoiling long. Some of them seized the arms of the soldiers, ripped swords out of their hands, flung them bodily aside. Others found the heavy bar and curled around it and dragged it slowly aside, grating inch by inch, until it slid free of the first bracket entirely. The battering ram outside struck against the doors again, and they burst wide open, knocking men out of their way sprawling. Marek was on the other side, still on his horse, standing in his stirrups and blowing his horn. His face was bright with bloodlust and fury, so eager he didn't even look to see why the doors had opened so suddenly. The vines were rooted in the earth, around the stairs, thick dark nests of woody roots hiding in the corners and in the crevices of the broken steps, barely visible in the early light of morning. Marek leaped his horse straight over them without a glance, charging up the stairs and through the broken doorway, and all his remaining knights came pouring in behind him. Their swords rose and fell in a bloody rain, and the barren soldiers were stabbing up at them with spears. Horses screamed and fell, kicking in their death throes as men died around them. Tears were falling off my face onto the pages of the book, but I couldn't stop reading. Then something struck me, a hard blow that knocked out all my breath. The spell slid off my tongue. Perfect silence in my ears at first. Then a hollow roaring everywhere around me and Sarkon, drowning out all other sound without touching us. Like being directly in the narrow eye of a thunderstorm in the middle of a wide field, seeing the gray furious rain on every side not touching you, but knowing that in a moment, cracks began to open up running away from us, going through the book, through the chair, through the dais, through the floors and walls. They weren't cracks in wood and stone. They were cracks in the world. Inside them was nothing but flat dark absence. The beautiful golden volume of the summoning folded up on itself and sank like a stone vanishing into deep water. Sarkon had me by the arm and out of the chair and was leading me down from the dais. The chair was falling in too. Then the whole dais, all of it, collapsing into emptiness. Sarkon was still continuing the spell, or rather, holding it in place, repeating his last line over and over. I tried to join in with him again, just humming, but my breath kept disappearing. I felt so strange. My shoulder throbbed, but when I looked down at it, there didn't seem to be anything wrong. Then I looked farther down, slowly. There was an arrow shaft jutting out of me, just below my breast. I stared at it, puzzled. I couldn't feel it at all, The high, beautiful stained glass windows shattered outwards with faint, muffled pops as the cracks reached them, showers of colored glass falling. The cracks were spreading. Men fell into them, with cries that vanished as they did, swallowed up into silence. Chunks of the stone walls and floors were disappearing too. The walls of the tower groaned. Sarkon was holding the rest of the spell by the edge, barely, like a man trying to control a maddened horse. I tried to push him magic to do it with. He was supporting all my weight, his arm like iron around me. My legs stumbled over one another, almost dragging. My chest was beginning to hurt now, a sharp, shocking pain, as though my body had finally woken up and noticed something was very badly wrong. I couldn't breathe without wanting to scream, and I couldn't get enough air to scream. The soldiers were still fighting in a few places, others just fleeing the tower, trying to get away from the crumbling world. I glimpsed Marek kicking free of his dead horse, jumping over another crack that ran down the floor towards him. Between the ruined doors, the queen appeared, morning light shining behind her, and for one moment I thought instead of a woman, there was a tree in the doorway, a silver, barked tree stretching from the floor up to the ceiling. Then Sarkon drew me back with him into the stairway and led me down. The tower was shuddering, and stones were tumbling down the stairs behind us. Sarkon chanted his last line of the spell, with each step, keeping the rest of the spell from bursting free. I couldn't help him. I opened my eyes again, with Kasha kneeling next to me, anxiously. The air was full of dust, but the shuddering of the walls had stopped at least. I was leaning against the wall of the cellar. We were underground. I didn't remember coming the rest of the way down the stairs. Nearby, the Baron was shouting instructions to his remaining soldiers. They were pushing over wine racks and barrels and heaping iron pots into a barricade at the bottom of the stairs, shoring it up with crumbled stone. I could see sunlight coming down from above, around the turn in the stairs. Sarkon was next to me, still chanting the same line over and over, his voice going hoarse. He'd put me next to a locked cabinet beside us made of metal. There were scorched marks around the handles. He motioned Kasha towards the lock. She took it by the handle. Flame boiled out of the lock, lapping around her hands. But she gritted her teeth and broke it open anyway. A rack of small jars of faintly glowing liquid stood inside. Sarkon took one out and pointed at me. Kasha stared at him and then down at the arrow. "I should pull it out," she said. He made a pushing gesture with his hand forward. She swallowed and nodded. She knelt down next to me again and said, "Nieszka, hold on." She took the arrow between her hands and broke off the feathered shaft that still stuck out of my chest. The arrowhead shivered inside me. My mouth opened and closed, agony silent. I couldn't breathe. Hurrying, she picked off the worst splinters and made it smooth as she could, and then she turned me to my side, against the wall, and with one horrible shove, pushed the arrow the rest of the way through me. She caught the arrowhead coming out of my back and pulled it all the rest of the way through. I moaned, and blood ran hot down my front and back. Sarkon had opened the jar. He poured the liquid into the cup of his hand and now rubbed it on my skin, pressing it into the open wound. It burned horribly. I tried to push him away with one feeble hand. He ignored me, pulling my dress aside to put on more of it. Then Kasha pushed me forward, and they poured it down into the wound on my back. I screamed then, and suddenly I could scream. Kasha gave me a wad of cloth to bite on. I bit and shuddered around it. The pain got worse instead of better. I pulled away from them and tried to press myself into the wall, the cool, hard stone, as if I could make myself a part of it and be unfeeling.
I dug my fingernails into the mortar, whining, Kasha's hand on my shoulder. And then, the worst of it was past. The running blood slowed and stopped. I began to be able to see again. And here, fighting on the stairs, the dull clang of swords striking each other, the stone walls, scraping metal, and occasionally a ringing note. Blood was trickling down through the barricade. Sarkan had sunk back against the wall next to me, his lips still moving, but almost no sound coming anymore, his eyes clenched shut with strain. The summoning was like a sandcastle with one side washed away, the rest ready to come sliding down. He was holding it up with raw strength. If the rest came down, I wondered, if that nothingness would swallow up the whole tower, devour all of us, and leave a blank empty hole in the world, and then close in. The mountainside tumbling to fill the eaten away hollow in the earth, as if all of us had never existed at all. He opened his eyes and looked at me. He gestured to Kasha, to the children huddled behind her, peering afraid over a barrel. Sarkan gestured again. Go. He meant me to take them and flee, to whisk us away somewhere. I hesitated, and his eyes glittered at me, angrily. He waved his hand in a sweep of the empty floor. The book was gone. The summoning was gone. We couldn't finish the spell, and when his strength ran out, I drew a breath and laced my hand with his and went back into the spell. He resisted. I sang softly at first, in short bursts of air, feeling my way. We didn't have a map anymore, and I didn't remember the words, but we've done this before. I remembered where we were going, what we were trying to build. I pushed up more sand against the wall, and dug a moat against the coming waves. I made it long and wide. I kept humming, bits of stories and songs. I began to heap up the sand again in my mind. He held back, baffled, not sure how to help me. I sang him something longer, putting a bit of melody, like a handful of wet pebbles, into his hands, and he slowly gave it back to me, chanted slow and precise and even, laying the stones, one by one, around along the base of the wet sand wall, shoring our tower up. The working was growing stronger, more solid once again. We'd stopped the slide. I kept on going, poking here and there, finding a way of showing it to him. I piled on more sand and let him smooth the wall and make it even. Together, we stuck a fluttering leaf branch into the top for a flying pennant. My breath still came short. I could feel an odd, puckering knot in my chest, and a deep, tight pain where the potion still worked away. But magic was running clear through me, bright and quick, overflowing. Men were shouting. The last of the Baron's men were scrambling over the barricade from the other side, most of them swordless and only trying to escape. A light was coming down the staircase, screams coming before it. The soldiers reached up hands, help the fleeing men down and over. There weren't very many of them. The flow stopped, and the soldiers threw the last of the sticks and big iron cauldrons on top, blocked off the passage as much as they could. Marek's voice echoed from behind it, and I glimpsed the queen's head, golden. The Baron's soldiers jabbed spears down at her that turned aside on her skin. The barricade was coming apart. We still couldn't let the spell go. Kasha was standing up. She was pushing open the door to the tomb. Down there, quick, she told the children. They scrambled into the stairwell. She caught my arm and helped me up. Sarkan struggled to his feet. She pushed us inside and picked up her sword from the floor and snatched another sealed jar from the cabinet. This way, she shouted to the men. They came piling in after us. The summoning came with us. I went around and around the turning steps, Sarkhan just behind me, magic singing between us. I heard a grinding noise above, and the stairway grew darker. Up above, one of the soldiers had pushed the door shut. The line of old letters to either side shone in the dimness and murmured faintly, and I found myself changing our working a little, to slide gently against their magic. Suddenly, my sense of our inner tower changed. It grew wider and more broad, terraces and windows forming, a gold dome at the top, walls of pale white stone, inscribed in silver, like the stairway walls. Sarkhan's voice slowed. He saw it too. The old tower, the lost tower, long ago. Light was dawning all around us. We spilled out into the round room at the bottom of the stairs. The air was stifling, not enough for all of us, until Kasha took up one of the old iron candlesticks and used the base of it to smash open the wall to the tomb, bricks tumbling in. Cool air came rushing in as she pushed the children inside and told them to hide behind the old king's coffin. Far above came the sound of breaking stone. The queen was leading Marek and his men in after us. A few dozen soldiers crammed themselves into the room and against the walls, their faces afraid. They wore yellow surcoats, or what was left of them. So they were with us, but I didn't recognize any of their faces. I didn't see the Baron. Swords rang again, distantly. The last of the Yellow Marsh's soldiers, still pent up on the stairs, were fighting. The light of the summoning was building quickly. Marek stabbed the last man in the stairwell and kicked the body, tumbling in onto the floor. Soldiers jumped forward to meet him, almost eagerly. At least, he was an enemy who made sense. Someone who could be defeated. But Marek met one swing on his shield, ducked under it, and thrust his sword through the man's body. He whirled and took off the head of the man on the other side. Clubbed one man with his sword hilt as he finished the swing, and stabbed forward to take another one in the eye. Kasha took a step beside me, a cry of protest, her sword rising. But they were all down before she'd even finished the sound. But we finished the summoning. I sang the last three words, and Sarkhan sang them after, and we sang them together once more. Light dawned blazing through the room, glowing almost from within the marble walls. Marek pushed forward into the space he'd cleared, and the queen came down behind him. Her sword hung, dripping blood. Her face was calm and still and serene. The light shone on her and through her, steady and deep. There was no trace of corruption. Marek was clear, and Sole behind him also. The light, washing over her, caught them both at the edges, and there weren't shadows in them. Only a hard glittering kind of selfishness, pride, like spiked citadel walls. But there wasn't even any of that in the queen. I stared at her, panting, baffled. There was no corruption inside her. Nothing at all was inside her. The light of the summoning shone straight through. She was rotted out from the inside. Her body just the skin of bark around an empty space. There wasn't anything left of her to corrupt. I understood too late. We'd gone in to save Queen Hana, so the wood had let us find what we were looking for. But what we'd found had only ever been a hollow remnant, a fragment of a heart tree's core. A puppet, empty and waiting, until we'd finished all our trials. Convinced ourselves there was nothing wrong, and the wood could reach out and take up the strings. The light kept pouring over her, and slowly I made out the wood at last, as if I'd looked again at a cloud shape and seen a tree instead of a woman's face. The wood was there. It was the only thing there. The golden strands of her hair were the pale veins of leaves, and her limbs were branches, and her toes were long roots crawling out over the floor, roots going deep into the ground. She was looking at the wall behind us, at the broken opening going through to the tomb with its blue flame. And for the first time, her face changed, a change like the twisting of a slim willow bending in a high wind, the rage of a storm in the treetops, that animating power in the wood. Whatever it was, it had been here before. Queen Hannah's milk-pale face was slipping away under the summoning's light, like paint washed away by running water. There was another queen beneath, all brown and green and golden. Her skin, patterned like alderwood, and her hair, a deep green, nearly black, threaded with red and gold and autumn brown. Someone had picked the gold strands of her hair out and braided them into a circlet for her head, white ribbons threaded through, and she wore a white dress that sat on her wrongly. She'd put it on, though it meant nothing to her. I saw the buried king's body take shape between her and us. He was carried by six men on a sheet of white linen, his face still and unmoving, the eyes filmed over with milk. They carried him into the tomb. They lowered him gently into the great stone coffin. They folded in the linen over his body. In the summoning light, that other queen followed the men into the tomb chamber. She bent over the coffin. There was no sorrow in her face, only a bewildered confusion, as if she didn't understand. She touched the king's face, touched the lids of his eyes with strangely long fingers, knobbled like twigs. He didn't stir. She startled and drew her hand back, out of the way of the men. They put the lid upon the coffin, and the blue flame erupted atop it. She watched them, still baffled. One of the attending men spoke to her, ghostly, telling her, I think, to stay as long as she wished. He bowed, and stooping, left the tomb through the opening, leaving her. There was something in his face as he turned away from her that the summoning caught even from so long ago. Something cold and determined. The Wood Queen didn't see it. She was standing at the stone coffin, her hands spread over the top of it, uncomprehending as Marisha had been. She didn't understand death. She stared at the blue flame, watching it leap. She turned all around in the bare stone room, looking around it with a wounded, appalled face. And then she stopped and looked again. Bricks were being laid in a small opening of the wall. She was being closed up inside the tomb. She stared for a moment, and then rushed forward and knelt before the remaining opening. The men had already pushed blocks into most of the space, working quickly. The cold-faced man was speaking sorcery while they worked, blue-silver light crackling out of his hands, over the blocks, mortaring them together. She reached a hand through in protest. He didn't answer her. He didn't look at her face. None of them looked at her. They closed up the wall with one last block, pushing her hand back into the room with it. She stood up alone. She was startled, angry, full of confusion, but she wasn't yet afraid. She raised a hand. She meant to do something. But behind her, the blue flame was leaping on the stone tomb. The letters around the sides were catching the light, shining out, completing the long sentence from the stairs. She whirled, and I could read them with her. Remain eternal. Rest eternal. Never moving. Never leaving. And they weren't just a poem for the king's rest. This wasn't a tomb. This was a prison. A prison meant to hold her. She turned and beat against the wall. She tried vainly to push against it, to work her fingers into the cracks.
Terror was climbing in her. Stone shut her in, cold and still. They had quarried this room out of the roots of the mountains. She couldn't get out. She couldn't. Abruptly, the Wood Queen heaved the memories away. The light of the summoning broke and ran away over the stones of the tomb like water. Sarkhan staggered back. I nearly fell against the wall. We were back in the round room, but the queen's fear rattled against the inside of my ribs, like a bird beating itself against walls. Shut away from the sun, shut away from water, shut away from air. And she still couldn't die. She hadn't died. She stood among us, only half hidden behind Queen Hannah's face. And she wasn't the queen in that vision anymore either. She'd fought her way out somehow. She'd won free, and then she'd kill them? She'd kill them, and not only them, but their lovers and children and all their people. She'd devoured them, become as monstrous as they had been. She'd made the wood. She hissed softly in the dark. Not a snake's hiss, but the rustling of leaves, the scrape of three branches rubbing in the wind. And as she stepped forward, vines came boiling down the stairs behind her, grabbing all the remaining men by ankle and wrist and throat, dragging them up against the walls and ceiling out of her way. Sarkhan and I were still struggling to our feet. Kasha put herself before us like a shield and chopped the vines away from us, keeping us free, but others snaked around behind her and into the tomb. They lashed around the children and started to drag them forward, Marisha screaming as Stashik hacked at the vines uselessly until they seized his arm too. Kasha took a step away from us, towards the children, her face in agony, unable to protect us all. And then Marek sprang forward. He slashed the vines apart, his own sword gleaming around the edges. He put himself between the queen and the children, and thrust them with his shield arm back into the safety of the burial chamber. He stood before the queen. She halted before him, and he said, "Mother!" fiercely, and dropped his sword to seize her by the wrists. He looked down into her face as she turned it slowly up towards him. "Mother," he said, "fight free of her. It's Marek. It's Marichek. Come back to me." I pulled myself up the wall. He blazed with determination, with longing. His armor was washed with blood and smoke, his face smeared with one bright red streak. But he looked for a moment like a child, or maybe a saint, pure with want. And the queen looked at him and put her hand on his chest and killed him. Her fingers turned into thorns and twigs and vines. She sank them through his armor and closed her hand like a fist. If there was anything left of Queen Hannah, any thin scraping of will, maybe she spent it then, on one small mercy. He died without knowing he'd failed. His face didn't change. His body slid easily off her hand, not much altered, only the hole in his breastplate where her wrist had gone in. He fell to the floor on his back, his armor ringing on the flagstones, still clear-eyed and certain. Certain he would be heard. Certain he would be victorious. He looked like a king. He'd caught us all in his own certainty. For a moment, we were all shocked into stillness. Sole inhaled once, stricken. Then Kasha sprang forward, swinging her sword. The queen caught it on her own blade. They stood fixed, pressed against each other, a few sparks glittering away from the grinding blades, and the queen leaned in and forced her slowly down. Sarkhan was speaking, an incantation of heat and flame rolling off his tongue. And fire came gouting out of the ground around the queen's legs, yellow-red and searing. The flames blackened Kasha's skin, where they licked against her. It ate up both the swords. Kasha had to roll away. The queen's silver mail melted and ran off her in streams of shining liquid that puddled on the floor and covered over with blackened crust. Her shift billowed into hot smoky flames. But the fire didn't touch her body. The queen's pale limbs stayed straight and unmarred. Sole was throwing his white lash against her as well, the flames crackling to blue where his fire and the dragon's met. That mingled blue fire ran twisting all over her body, trying to seek out a weakness, find a way in. I gripped Sarkhan's hand. I fed him magic and strength so he could keep beating her back with flame. His fires were crisping up the vines. The soldiers who hadn't been strangled were dragging themselves, staggering away, back up the stairs. At least they were escaping. Other spells, one after another, came to me. But I knew without beginning that they wouldn't work. Fire wouldn't burn her. Blade wouldn't cut her, no matter how long we hacked away. I wondered in horror if we shouldn't have let the summoning fail. If that great nothingness could have taken her. But I didn't think even that would have done it. There was too much of her. She could have filled in any holes we made in the world, and still had more of herself left over. She was the wood. Or, the wood was her. Her roots went too deep. Sarkhan's breath was coming in long drags, whenever he could get it. Sole sank down onto the stairs, spent, and his white fire died. I gave Sarkhan more strength, but soon he'd fall too. The queen turned towards us. She didn't smile. There wasn't triumph in her face, only an unending wrath and the awareness of victory. Behind her, Kasha stood up. She drew Alosha's sword from over her shoulder. She swung. The sword blade sliced into the queen's throat and stuck there, halfway through. A hollow, roaring noise began, my ear bones crackling, and the whole room darkening. The queen's face stilled. The sword began to drink, and drink, and drink, endlessly thirsty, wanting more. The noise climbed higher. It felt like a war between two endless things, between a bottomless chasm and the running river. We all stood frozen, watching, hoping. The queen's expression didn't change. Where the sword stuck in her throat, a black glossy sheen was trying to take hold of her flesh, spreading from the wound, like ink clouding through a glass of clean water. She put a hand slowly up and touched the wound with her fingers, and a little of the same gloss came away on her fingertips. She looked down at it. And then she looked back up at us with sudden contempt, almost a shake of her head, as if to tell us we'd been foolish. She sank down suddenly onto her knees, her head and body and limbs all jerking, like a marionette whose puppeteer had dropped the strings. And all at once, Sarkhan's flames caught in Queen Hana's body. Her short golden hair went up in a smoky cloud. Her skin blackened and split. Pale gleams showed through beneath the charred skin. For a moment, I thought maybe it had worked. Maybe the sword had broken the Wood Queen's immortality. But pale white smoke came billowing out of those cracks, torrents of it, and roared away past us, escaping, just like the Wood Queen had escaped her prison once before. Alosha's sword kept trying to drink her up, to catch at the streams of smoke, but they boiled away too quickly, rushing past even the sword's hungry grasp. Sole covered his head as they fled over him and up the stairs. Others twisted out through the air channel,
still more, dived into the burial chamber, and up and vanished. Through a tiny chink in the roof, I couldn't have noticed the thinnest crack. Kasia had flung herself atop the children. Sarkan and I huddled against the wall, covering our mouths. The Wood Queen's essence dragged over our skin with the oily horror of corruption, the warm stink of old leaves and mold. And then it was gone. She was gone. Queen Hannah's body crumbled away all at once, like a used-up log falling into ashes. Alyosha's sword fell to the floor clattering. We were alone, our rasping breaths the only sound. All the living soldiers had fled. The dead had been swallowed by the vines and the fire, leaving nothing but smoky ghosts on the white marble walls. Kasia sat up slowly. The children gathered against her. I sank to the floor on my knees, shaking with horror and despair. Marek's hand lay open near me. His face gazed up sightless from the middle of the room, surrounded by charred stone and melted steel. The dark blade was dissolving into the air. In a moment, nothing remained but the empty hilt. Alyosha's sword was spent, and the Wood Queen had survived. Chapter 29. We carried the children out of the tower into morning sun, pouring down bright and improbable on the silent wreckage of 6,000 men. There were flies already buzzing thickly, and the crows had come in flocks. When we came out, they burst up from the ground and perched on the walls to wait for us to get out of their way. We had passed the Baron in the cellar, leaning against the wall of the hearth, his eyes blank and unseeing, blood puddled beneath him. Kasia had found one of the sleep potions, still unbroken in its flask, gripped in the hand of the man-at-arms, slumped dead beside him. She opened it and gave the children each a swallow down there, before we brought them out. They'd seen more than enough already. Now Stashek hung limp over her shoulder, and Sarkan carried a huddled Marisha in his arms. I struggled on behind them, too hollow to be sick anymore, too dry for tears. My breath was still short and painful in my chest. Sole walked with me, giving me a hand occasionally over a particularly high mound of armored corpses. We hadn't taken him prisoner. He'd just followed us out, trailing after us with a puzzled look, like a man who knew he wasn't dreaming, but felt he should have been. Down in the cellar, he'd given Sarkan what was left of his cloak to wrap around the little princess. The tower was still standing, barely. The floor of the great hall was a maze of broken flagstones, dead roots and withered vines sprawled over them, charred up like the queen's body below. Several of the columns had collapsed entirely. There was a hole in the ceiling into the library above, and a chair had fallen partway into it. Sarkan looked up at it as we left, climbing over blocks and rubble. We had to walk the full length of the walls we'd built to try and keep Marek out. The voices of the old stone whispered sadly to me as we came through the archways. We saw no one living until we came out into the abandoned camp. At least there were a few soldiers there, rummaging through the supplies. A couple of them burst out of the pavilion, running away from us, carrying silver cups. I would have gladly paid a dozen silver cups just to hear another mortal voice, to be able to believe that not everyone was dead. But they all fled, or hid from us, behind tents or supply heaps, peering out. We stood in the silent field, and after a moment I said, "The cannon crew," remembering. They were still there, a stone company, pushed out of the way, blank gray eyes fixed on the tower. Most of them hadn't been badly broken. We stood around them silently. None of us had enough strength to undo the spell.
Finally, I reached out to Sarkin. He shifted Marisha to his other arm and let me take his hand. We managed to pull enough magic to undo the spell. The soldiers writhed and jerked as they came loose from the stone, shaking with the sudden return of time and breath. Some of them had lost fingers, or had new pitted scars where their bodies had been chipped. But these were trained men, who managed cannon that roared as terribly as any spell. They edged back from us, wide-eyed. But then they looked at Solia. They recognized him, at least.
"Orders, sir?"
one of them asked him uncertainly. He stared back blankly a moment, and then looked at us, just as uncertainly. We walked down to Alshanka together, the road still dusty from so much use yesterday. Yesterday. I tried not to think about it. Yesterday, 6,000 men had marched over this road. Today, they were all gone. They lay dead in the trenches. They lay dead in the hole, in the cellars, on the long winding stairs going down. I saw their faces in the dust while we walked. Someone in Alshanka saw us coming, and Boris came out with a wagon to carry us the rest of the way. In the back we swayed with the wheels, like sacks of grain. The creaking was every song I'd ever heard about war and battle. The horses clopping along, the drum beat. All those stories must have ended this same way, with someone tired going home from a field full of death. But no one ever sang this part. Boris's wife Natalia put me to sleep in Marta's old room, a little bedroom full of sun, with a worn rag doll sitting on the shelf, and a small outgrown quilt. She'd gone to her own home now, but the room was still shaped around her, a warm, welcoming place, ready to receive me. And Natalia's hand on my forehead was my mother, telling me to sleep. Sleep. The monsters wouldn't come. I shut my eyes and pretended to believe her. I didn't wake again until evening, a warm summer evening with a gentle twilight falling blue. There was a familiar, comfortable rising bustle in the house. Someone getting supper. Others coming in from the day's work. I sat at the window without moving for a long time more. They were much richer than my family. They had an upstairs part in their house, just for the bedrooms. Marisha was running in the big garden with a dog and four other children, most of them older than her. She was in a fresh cotton dress, marked up with grass stains, and her hair slipping out of tidy braids. But Stashek was sitting near the door, watching them, though one of the others was a boy his age. Even in simple clothes, he didn't look anything like an ordinary child, with his shoulders very straight and his face solemn as church.
"We have to take them back to Kralja," Sola said. Given time to rest, he'd gathered back up some of his outrageous self-assurance, seating himself down in our company as though he'd been with us all along. It was dark. The children had been put to bed. We were sitting in the garden, with glasses of cool plum brandy, and I felt as though I were pretending to be grown up. It was too much like my parents taking visitors to sit in the chairs and the shady swinging bench just inside the forest, talking of crops and families, and meanwhile, all of us children ran cheerfully amok, finding berries or chestnuts, or just having games of tag. I remembered when my oldest brother married Malgosha, and suddenly the two of them stopped running around with us and started sitting with the parents. A very solemn kind of alchemy, one that I felt shouldn't have been able to just sneak up on me. It didn't seem real even to be sitting here at all, much less talking of thrones and murder quite seriously, as if those were themselves real things and not just bits out of songs. I felt even more peculiar listening to them all argue.
"Prince Stashek must be crowned at once and the regency established," Solia was going on. "The Archduke of Gidna and the Archduke of Varsha, at least..." "Those children aren't going anywhere but to their grandparents," Kasha said.
if I have to put them on my back and carry them all the way myself.
My dear girl, you don't understand, Sola said.
I am not your dear girl, Kasha said, with a bite in her tone that silenced him. If Stashik's the king now, all right. The kings asked me to take him and Marisha to their mother's family. That's where they're going.
The capital is too close in any case. Sarkon flicked his fingers, impatient, dismissive.
I do understand. The Archduke of Farsha won't want the king in the hands of Gidna, he added peevishly when Sola drew breath to argue. And I don't care. Kralia wasn't safe before. It won't be safer now.
But nowhere will be safe, I said, breaking in on them, bewildered. Not for long. They were all quarreling, it seemed to me, about whether to build a house on this side or that of a river, and ignoring the spring flood mark on a tree nearby, higher than either door would be. After a moment, Sarkon said, Gidna is on the ocean. The northern castles will be well placed to mount a substantial defense.
The wood will come anyway, I said. I knew it. I'd looked into the Wood Queen's face, felt that implacable wrath beating against my skin. All these years, Sarkon had held the wood back, like a tide, behind a dam of stone. He'd diverted its power away into 1,000 streams and wells of power, scattered throughout the valley. But it was a dam that couldn't hold forever. Today, next week, next year, the wood would break through. It would reclaim all those wells, those streams, go roaring up to the mountainside. And fueled with all that new-won strength, it would come over the mountain passes. There wasn't going to be any strength to meet them. The army of Polnia was shattered, the army of Rossia wounded, and the wood could afford to lose a battle, or two, or a dozen. It would establish its footholds and scatter its seeds. And even if it was pushed back over one mountain pass or another, that wouldn't matter in the end. It would keep coming. She would keep coming. We might hold the wood off long enough for Stashik and Marisha to grow up, grow old, even die. But what about Boris and Natalia's grandchildren running with them in the garden? Or their own children, growing up in the lengthening shadow?
We can't keep holding the wood back with Polnia burning behind us, Sarkon said. The Rossians will come over the Ridva for vengeance as soon as they know Marek is dead.
We can't hold the wood back at all, I said. That's what they tried. That's what you've been doing.
We have to stop it for good. We have to stop her. He glared at me. Yes, what a marvelous idea. If Alyosha's blade couldn't kill her, nothing can. What do you propose to do?
I stared back and saw the nodding fear in my stomach reflected in his eyes. His face stilled. He stopped glaring. He sank back in his chair, still staring at me. Sola eyed us both in confusion, and Kasha watched me with worry in her face. But there wasn't anything else to do.
I don't know, I said to Sarkon, my voice shaking. But I'll do something. Will you come into the wood with me?
Kasha stood with me, irresolute, at the crossroads outside Alshanka, unhappy. The sky was still the first pale pink-gray of morning.
Nyeshka, if you think I can help you, she said softly, but I shook my head.
I kissed her. She put her arms around me carefully and tightened her embrace little by little, until she was hugging me. I closed my eyes and held her close, and for a moment we were children again, girls again, under a distant shadow, but happy anyway. Then the sun came down the road and touched us. We let go and stepped back. She was golden and stern, almost too beautiful to be living, and there was magic in my hands. I took her face in my hands a moment. We leaned our foreheads together, and then she turned away. Stashik and Marisha were sitting in the wagon, watching anxiously for Kasha, with Sola next to them. One of the soldiers was driving.
Some more men had come wandering back into town, those who'd run away from the fighting and the tower before the end.